Thank you, Maria. I'm very happy to be here. I've enjoyed myself thoroughly so far because there's an awesome breadth of knowledge and interest in the room, and we're all united around understanding hearing and have our various things we love about it. But we can all learn from each other, and so I'm going to present today some of the ways that we use the Songbird auditory system to understand. My main interest is social communication, but also brain evolution and brain development, the effects of experience on the auditory system development, and how in communication the sender's motor system aligns with the receiver's sensory systems. And so my talk on Friday will be a research talk on that topic, and today is like a smorgasbord of the different ways that we approach these questions using the Songbird, and I'll tell you one little story about what one thing we have found. But in general, I'm going to go over what's the use of this animal in particular, and what we've been able to learn about auditory processing and perception and vocal communication using this animal. Okay, so songbirds have the, I'm just going to cut to the chase here in case somebody doesn't know. One of the major issues in understanding the neurobiology of speech learning, speech perception, speech production is that it was incredibly difficult to find an animal model of this, okay? So in neurobiology, we have our questions. So many people's questions begin with human questions. Mine really frankly didn't, although I do think speech and language are fascinating. But the study of speech, the quantitative study of speech, we argue with me if you want to, started with the invention of the sound spectrograph. So we could visualize, print, measure. What?
That was a dead end.
Well, maybe you'll think differently after this talk. So at the very first paper out of Bell Labs on the sound spectrograph and speech and how we could see speech and measure everything about speech, well, those very first papers were accompanied by the first papers on the experimental analysis of birdsong. So the minute Thorpe heard of the sound spectrograph invention, he started bringing birds into his lab at Cambridge in the 50s, and started testing the long lore mysterious possibility that songbirds learned their vocalizations that they use to communicate. No ape can, no monkey can, no rodent can, we think maybe whales can, but they are difficult indeed to do experimental studies with. Rearing a whale isolate, I would not want to do myself. And so the naturalists had been reporting that the birds of a species at one lake sounded like that species, but all had a little signature that indicated that they lived at that lake. Well, the birds of the same species at a different lake sounded like that proper species, but they all had a little different signature. And the question was, is this population genetics? Is this rapid evolution? Or is this actually a learning process? Okay. And so the richness, the beginning richness of the system is that there are over 5,000 species of songbirds. And their vocalizations, their songs in particular, which I'm showing you spectrograms of here, their songs are the complex vocalizations they use. They use many calls, like a frog, like a monkey, etc. But these songs are much more acoustically complex, and it turns out, in fact, they are learned. And what's wonderful for us in trying to understand how the auditory system comes to function the way it does evolutionarily, developmentally, and the driving forces for that is that we have this acoustic diversity to work with. Not that my fellow neurobiologists use that acoustic diversity, but that's fine because it's more for me. So This is a zebra finch. These are three different species of astrilled finches, sort of closely related. They live in Australia and Southeast Asia. We know their phylogeny, which is extremely useful for relating genetic circuitry and the effects of development, the effects of experience. So this is the zebra finch, the laboratory mouse of the song neurobiology world. I'm going to play you his song. He does very well in the laboratory, and they are mature in 90 days. And one of the great things about this system is that in the laboratory, you can actually study natural behavior. The males use their songs to court females. The females use their auditory systems to analyze the songs of the males and decide which males will contribute to the next generation, based in part on the quality of his song, his plumage, his beak color, you know, those also matter. His general temperament, those also matter. Both of them need a really good auditory system. Okay, there's selection for both sexes, but for slightly different reasons. The male learns to sing and sings to the female. The female chooses a mate based on the song. And she also does things like sexually imprints on her tutor or adult father who she's reared with. And so she memorizes her tutor's or her father's song and remembers it the rest of her life, just like the young males do. Okay.
Females can vocalize no good as well.
Yeah, they have rich calls, but they don't have learned components, and they also don't have a song control system. So it's the biggest sex difference ever found in the brain, is the male versus the female songbird. There are these interconnected nuclei that I don't study, but everybody else in my field does, that are responsible for the acquisition of the motor performance and then the motor performance of the song. And if a female brain just doesn't have it. But if you take a juvenile female and you inject her with testosterone when she's young, she grows a song system and begins to sing. Okay, so it's remarkable.
Yeah, how much is missing actually in the females? Is it an area that's missing or some connections?
Yes, so there's like a, you know, vestigial premotor nucleus that is imperative for the male. It's called HVC and it's right here. And if you lesion this area here, the male gets up on the perch and Zippo comes out. So there's a vestigial, we always argue about this, vestigial version of that. There may be a motor area, but they're not connected. As far as we know, they're not connected with fibers. And then the anterior forebrain pathway, which is heavily in control of song behavior during the learning process and has to do with plasticity, is also absent in the female. Not in the females who sing, however. So in some species, females sing and males sing. In most, that's not the case. But in the case where females sing, they also have a song system.
If you give zebra finches testosterone, will they sing?
Females, when they're young. Yeah. But it's all, okay, the other interesting thing is that all of this learning, like us and speech, occurs within a critical period in development. Okay, so we can zero in development on what opens the brain up to incredibly complex learning capabilities, and then what closes it down.
Is it clear that we cannot learn language at a later stage, as you was?
Right. It's a hypothesis that puberty is the end of the critical period for the human. And all the studies that have reported that are horribly confounded, and they're case studies of some child literally locked in a closet until they have passed puberty, so they have cognitive, motor disabilities, etc. But there are also many very good speech development studies showing that, first of all, the native language sounds you hear in the first 12 months of your life shape the way you hear for the rest of your life. Okay, so before you even learn to speak, you have formed your perceptual skills around the phonemes of your native language. And then, this is very nice, you know, not very nice, but a sad learning and proficiency function, where if you bring a child, say, to the United States, and the child's not a native English speaker, if they're three, they get it, and they get it quickly. They learn very quickly that language, and they show proficiency as adults equal to a native language speaker from the get-go. Okay, and that's true up to about 7 days of age. Sorry, I'm in bird time. 7 years of age, and then after that, one's ability to learn a second language decreases, and that lasts throughout adulthood. So there are many good demonstrations. The only, thankfully, poor work is the work that demonstrates a critical period for speech and language acquisition in humans because they're terribly confounded. However, in the bird, we can manipulate lots of things. In the human world, it's called to raise a child without language exposure is called the forbidden experiment. Okay, and we do it every day with the finches. Rule number one in animal neurobiology, which many people seem to have forgotten of late, is if you're interested in a topic, speech acquisition, social communication, vocal learning, vocal communication, etc., you find an animal that can do that, that's good at that. Okay? And so if you're interested in hearing, auditory processing, and perception, you find an animal that uses the auditory system for important things. Okay. And the songbird is an example of that. Okay.
Yeah, on that question, so we had a talk last week by Andre Kosmarov on starlings, right?
Yeah.
So what are the typical model organisms for songbirds that people use? So zebrafinch, starling, are there some other typical?
The canary used to be one. When everyone was studying hormones, the canary was a laboratory subject. And then in the field, many of my colleagues are field biologists, which makes our field rich as well. So they're chasing white-crowned sparrows around, song sparrows, white-throated sparrows, but those wild birds do not do well in the laboratory. Like the starlings won't breed. So everyone who works on starlings, they have no idea what happened to them during development, and but they have a rich vocal repertoire, and they keep on learning past the critical period.
But sometimes it can be misleading. If the barn owl, for example, has been studied for many years in terms of their localization and so forth, and then later on it turned out that their principles are far from, let's say, the human way of coding.
Mammal.
Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes, of course, it's
exactly. Yeah, it's so true.
It's very specific.
So true. And so what?
What is some people study talking birds, like mine and their person?
Yeah, like a parrot. We call them vocal mimics. And there have been a few neurobiological, mostly anatomical studies, mm-hmm. and then some behavioral studies. Mm-hmm. But they are extremely long-lived, mm-hmm. okay? A African gray lives 80 to 100 years, and we don't know much about their it's harder to study their natural behavior, and so they just have not taken off as a model species.
So it's a sort of case like it would be interesting, but it's difficult. So
it would be interesting, but it's difficult, and it's also chasing a moving target.
Yeah, but clearly the hearing system would be very interesting because they can emulate the human speech, some of them extremely well.
Yeah. Yeah, so
they have very different, of course, production organs, but they have to be emulating something, which matters.
And they copy it beautifully, right? The fire engine.
Yeah, they emulate something which matters to humans because we understand them quite well.
Yeah, they do a beautiful, well, I know we just had a week of the beauty and complexity of the mammalian cochlea, but I'm sorry to tell y'all, birds can hear as well as we can, meaning that their perceptual skills are equivalent or to ours or top ours.
Yeah.
And
they don't have cochlea.
They do have a cochlea, they do.
Okay, so call it the punchline.
Birds are different from they don't have outer hair cell motel. They don't have outer hair cells, they don't have the tunnel of Corti. They have low frequency hearing, the cochlea is a curvilinear sheet of hair cells, and thus the whole functioning is more simple. They have one middle ear bone rather than three.
The whole point is they are emulating something which pleases us. And if you look at the spectra, I mean, it can be good for something, I'm not saying. It looks very different. If you look at the speech of the talking birds, it doesn't look much as like a human spectra.
Right.
So what is it that they are doing is very interesting, because we like it. Our hearing system likes it. Our cognitive system likes it.
Right.
You understand what they are saying.
Yeah.
And somehow they figure out what it is that it's that matters.
Yes.
That's how they are speaking.
Do the speech recognizers?
Not very well. I mean, they should, quite frankly. You know, seriously, they should. I knew the guy in Japan who was always going to this speech recognition meeting that saying exactly that, until your machines understand my word, you're doing something wrong. And I agree with him, basically, because the invariants are there. I mean,
One difference that is very, it's very clear, is that the bird, the songbird, in particular, has a far more complex and facile vocal organ than does the primate.
But I'm seriously talking not about songbirds, but I'm talking about not songbirds. I talk the birds which can speak.
Right, mimics, vocal mimics as well. And they clearly are compelled to do so not just for social reinforcement. So they do use their vocalizations to communicate in the wild. It's just harder to study them.
Sure.
Okay. So these three species are my current species of choice, although we're expanding to six species this summer. So the zebrafinch we know the most about behaviorally and neurobiologically. The long-tailed finch, and I've chosen these to study because their songs are very different, even though they're closely related. The long-tailed finch is also an Australian bird, and it sings a more tonal song. And then the Bengalese finch, it sings a trilled but higher pitched than the zebrafinch song. I'm going to play these for you so you get a sense of the diversity. Do we have sound? We don't.
There should be.
Oh, actually,
okay. 1 second.
If we're quiet, you can hear it. Okay, that was a little honky honk honk honk. Okay, and so everyone laughs when they first hear a zebrafinch. They can't believe we study that, right? So noisy honks, nice harmonic stacks, and broadband.
And it just sounds periodic with like a repetition.
Yes, it's actually there's a motif structure. So the bird sings syllable A, B, C, D, E, A, B, C, D, E, A, B, C, D, E. This bird does. And so that repetition you hear is on the order of a second.
People are surprised because they don't understand why you would want more of this in your life than you absolutely have.
Yeah, exactly. And when you go into my colony where there are 250, and they do not shut up, except at night. You know, after a while, you're like, oh. So this bird sounds quite different, even though they're closely related. And you can tell by reading the spectrogram, what is it going to sound more like? More tonal and right? Higher pitched as well. So this is the top spectrogram. Very... quite different. Each bird's song is unique because he learns it. He learns it from his father and tweaks it. We call it improvisation, and all my music pals are like, that is not improvisation, Sarah. So he takes the father's song and maybe doubles a syllable, lengthens a syllable, drops a syllable, and makes it his own. So brothers sound similar. Family members sound similar, but everyone has a unique song. And that's important because that means that each individual is identifiable as a social partner. And these are colony living animals. They deal with each other every day. Okay, here's another one. Okay, did you hear? No, I still suck at that one. But did you hear that? I mean, that one's easy to follow. Like when I first teach students, this is birdsong, you know, and it is like, I can't follow that. This is a good training spectrogram sound. Okay, and the Bengalese finch is not even really a species. It's so domesticated. But it is domesticated from a bird called the white-rumped nubia. Okay, so fast syllables. Okay, so these are what we call syllables. And then this syllable, if you look closely, is composed of two notes that are acoustically distinct but don't have silence between them. And then the syllables are put together in a syntax that is called a motif. And the zebra finch repeats his motif over and over again in a bout. And often the long tail will sing one long motif and maybe another, but he's much less machine-like than the zebra finch. And the Bengalese is a little different. He just rambles, okay? And his syntax is, in fact, probabilistic, not deterministic, okay? So it does happen, but most of the time you can predict which syllable will come next in the zebra finch's song and in a long-tailed finch's song. This bird has more variability in its syntax.
So concerning the syllables, so on the, like, for that first finch, it looks like they're clearly distinct because there's a silent period between syllables?
Yes.
Is it always so clear, or are there songs where it's less clear what one syllable is because
it's quite, they might quite transition, clear.
Or are they always, like, they always have that sharp, basically,
they do.
Gap?
They do. They do have really clear intersyllable intervals, although their intersyllable intervals are shorter than this bird. And this bird also has pretty clear intersyllable intervals despite the probabilistic syntax. Okay, so we choose these because their audiograms are quite similar. The range of frequencies represented in the songs are quite similar, but it's the interesting spectrotemporal dynamics that make them distinct. Okay, and this is a, you know, property of vocalizations. Vocalizations have statistical structure, and we ask, well, does the auditory system take into account the statistical structure? Are the tuning properties of auditory neurons mapped on to acoustic features that are in conspecific song, or the song of your father, or the song you learned, or the song of your mate?
I think that the resolution properties, are they as similar between these, as in terms of frequency selectivity or temporal resolution? Is this similar across species, or is it very different?
In neurons?
Yes. So also in terms of perception, or I don't know if you can measure
right.
that.
Yes,
or
we can.
Physiologically, I mean, so, that tuning, is to be, do you say they have all the cochlea, so they have some type of selectivity, I guess?
Frequency. Yes, well, they do.
Yeah. Is it similar across species, or is it...
Okay, so that's what I'll tell you about. So the cochlea is quite similar across these birds. Their audiograms, their ABRs are very similar. And it's in the brain where you find tuning properties that you map onto song, although we didn't know that before we started investigating. First the zebra finch, and now these birds. You really need to study more than one species to find out what is, you know, if there's a real match at the species level in terms of tuning and vocal production. And in our case, how vocal learning shapes them, which is what I'll talk about on Friday. Or we can just talk about it now. Yeah, so these are, you know, right now, these are the questions that we're focused on, but it took a long time to get here, okay? Because we didn't know anything about the response properties of the songbird auditory system, okay? The cochlea, we knew a little bit about. There were auditory nerve fiber recordings in the 70s and 80s. We know that they hear only up to 10K max, any bird we've ever found. Our birds don't even hear this. Okay, their sweet spot is 2 to 4 kilohertz in the audiogram, and then they fall off such that this is really superfluous. You have to blast that, and we've probably found out of, you know, 12,000 neurons in the last few years, we've probably found 2 that had a best frequency of 8 kilohertz.
But for domesticated birds, maybe it's not superfluous because we can hear it, and like orchids,
they persuade us to propagate them.
True. In fact, there's a special kind of canary called the Belgian water schlager. Has anybody ever heard of this bird? And you're exactly right. Bird fanciers, okay, breed the birds for their plumage and for their songs. So the Belgian water schlager was bred for this very special song. It's a type of canary. It does. Turns out the Belgian water schlager has a genetic mutation such that its hair cells die, okay? And it can only hear super low frequencies, and that is what they bred for. But yes, you're right. But these birds are, if you record them in the wild, the songs are the same.
But did you say that they're only hearing, they're sensitive only between around 2 and 4 kilohertz?
They're most sensitive.
But they produce sounds that go up to 8 kilohertz or more?
Yes.
This is a bit weird.
Well, the thing is that if I low pass filter this song, I train my bird to recognize 4 zebrafinch songs and tell me which one he heard or she heard. I low pass filter it, they're fine. I high pass, just this top part, they have no idea what's going on. So we've done this frequency filtering, and now we're using vocoding to look specifically at the spectrum modulation frequency.
How different are the vocal organs of the different birds? Are they very similar?
They're very similar in these birds. Okay. They have what's called a syrinx instead of a larynx, mm-hmm. and they have many more muscles controlling mm-hmm. the syrinx than we have the larynx.
Syrinx is the main source of the sound?
Yeah. And they can get
kind of a bubble or something like this, right? I mean, how does syrinx look?
So they, right, so they have air sacs that provide the pressure, the air pressure, and they can control the two sides separately. So they can produce two totally different sounds simultaneously. And in fact, that's how they pull off often a long whistle, say.
So how many, what do you say, the degrees of freedom this system would have? I mean, how many things they can control? So you said two muscles? Is there something more?
No, many.
Opening or something?
Right, so they have many muscles controlling each side. The two sides can be completely separately controlled. We don't have that. They have many more muscles controlling.
Yeah. It ends up in 2 points.
Yes,
more.
It ends up two outputs, right, and then through a common channel.
There is a tongue.
Yeah, they move the tongue, and should I try to find a video? I'll find one for Friday. It's quite interesting because they move the beak like this, not a tongue, but there is a tongue and it's moving. And I do have colleagues who put tiny pressure detectors throughout the vocal cavity and along the syrinx and try to figure out exactly how they're breathing and singing, how they're producing one side versus the other.
Is their tongue as complicated as with the human?
What's that?
I mean, the human tongue is very, very versatile. Is it also with the bird?
Our guess is no. Our guess is that it's not used with the level of specificity that the human uses it, partially because we just don't have very good control over our larynx. Okay, so here's our, you know, diversity species-wise, and each individual learns to sing. So what happens is, these baby birds, unlike a duck or a goose who hatch out ready to roll, you know, these birds are incredibly altricial. When they hatch, they are pink little things, nothing but a beak and a gut and big closed eyes. Okay? And so they require a lot of care. In fact, like humans, but unlike other mammals, both male and female raise the offspring. So mostly in males, mummy and daddy meet in an alley. Okay? They mate, whoosh, daddy's gone, and mummy does the rest. Okay, that's not true in some monkeys, but it is common, rodents, etc. So it's so labor-intensive to raise a baby bird that it takes both parents. And some of us like to postulate that vocal learning evolved because she needs to know a lot more than his genes. She needs to know that his brain works properly, that he was raised right, he's going to be able to, you know, provide some of the resources, et cetera. It's just, I mean, there's no proper evidence for that. But it is an interesting difference. And so the young are taken care of, parented, warmed, fed constantly, because I have hand-fed these babies to get them going, and it is a minimum every 2 hours. Birds are basically on the brink of starvation at all times, because they have to be light. Okay, so there's a very close relationship between both parents and the offspring. This is a juvenile, when they both hatch out, when the males and females hatch out, you have no idea who's a male and who's a female. This is a father. He has the orange cheek patch and the zebra stripes that the female does not have. He also has polka dots here. And what happens is, this is now under debate because someone recently published a paper suggesting that there's an incubation call that goes on such that songbirds can hear in the egg. So it's out for debate, but we think hearing comes online around 10 days post-hatch. And we do know that the auditory brainstem response to simple sounds is mature at 20 days, okay? That coincides with the onset of the first critical period for song learning. Between 20 and roughly 45 days of age, a young male memorizes his father's song. And we know he memorizes it because if we let him have exposure to the singing father or tutor for 10 days, 2 days, etc., in this critical period, okay, and then we take the father away, the baby is at that time producing what's akin to babbling, and we call it subsong. And it's just this rambling thing. He's not doing it to anyone. He's doing it to the corner, okay, to himself. And if he's producing that, we take the father away, he eventually produces a lovely copy of the father's song. So that is the evidence that it is memorized first. Now, whether it's auditory, sensory motor, if there's a motor map created, we don't know. We debate about that all the time. Okay, so during this period, he hears and memorizes the father's song. He then begins to practice his own vocal output, listening to what he's singing and correcting his vocal output using auditory feedback. And so he hones and shapes his own song over this sensory motor, we call it the sensory motor integration period, where he practices. If you deafen him at this time, it's over. He can make no progress. Okay. And so he has to hear himself sing, but not the father, to perfect the song. And then at sexual maturity, which is 90 days of age, very nice for laboratory work, he fixes the song. It becomes stereotyped, and he normally does not change it throughout adulthood. Okay, making it a great model system for motor production, because you're not chasing a moving target, and it's incredibly precise. Okay.
There's no external feedback, so it's the bird itself that corrects his own song.
Yeah, he corrects his own.
He or she evaluates himself, or what?
That's right.
There's no external or other
feedback.
Okay,
so great question. We think there's coaching. We think there's coaching from the other family members, yeah. And you can observe brothers differentiating their songs or converging their songs. So others in the family definitely influence what they finalize. But if you leave him alone, which we do in the laboratory, when he after he's heard a tutor, or we record from the auditory cortex throughout the entire tutoring process in order to find out what's going on during song learning, and he has no exposure to anyone else, he develops a very nice song. But we do think that at least the mother is reinforcing certain things, and there are dynamics among the brothers. Okay, so it becomes stereotype. Okay, testosterone surge, something happens, and he cannot learn. Okay, but he does still need to hear himself to sing normally, even though he sings beautifully stereotyped song normally. If you deafen him, eventually his song will fall apart. Okay. He's the father. Let's see. Okay, so here's plastic song. So in this recording, he's already formed syllables. And you can do cluster analyses on the spectrograms or the acoustic features, and you can see the clusters emerge over time. And then his adult song is this. See, he adds a little call in there. Here's Papa. So if you hand me a spectrogram and you show me 15 adult males, I can tell you who the father was or who the tutor was. Okay. So it's very clear. Okay, and like I was telling you, it's also very, very important, and it's not like the female's doing nothing with her auditory system. The entire next generation depends upon her auditory system, okay? Her perceptual skills. So this is what a well-formed, well-learned song looks like. These are syllables, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, repeated, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, okay? And the female may be interested. Now, if we raise him with only females, he's well taken care of, but he's not tutored. He sings this, okay? And the females will have nothing to do with him. But the good part is they don't seem to know. Because when I walk in the colony, the isolates are just singing away. So here's a normal. Okay. Okay, now this is isolate. Stereotyped, but sad, pathetic, off pitch.
Stupid.
Something happened. Even woolly
lambs. When females are growing up, they're hearing their siblings learn, and they hear their fathers learn. And do they specifically look for mates that are outside the family group, or a little bit outside?
Right. So they do have. If you raise a female isolate, she will. She knows enough to go for the correct species. Now, if you rear her, which is one of the things we do all the time, we steal eggs out of one species nest and drop them in another species nest, so you're a zebra finch, but you grow up thinking you're a Bengalese finch, she is sexually imprinted on that Bengalese finch father, and so she is more likely, it's not deterministic, it's probabilistic, she's more likely to choose a Bengalese finch male. Okay, so this is just a, unfortunately, low resolution image of how we test behavioral preferences. We do classic operant conditioning to test perceptual skills, but we also test preferences. So it's pretty easy to do. You know, you have your little IR beam detectors, a perch in one end, a perch in another end. The cage is very symmetric. You have a sort of a sheer curtain hiding the reality of just the speaker back here, but she can see this 3D printed model of a finch, and she can see the same thing over here, and we let her acclimate. We also do this with males, let them acclimate, and then we show them this song's coming from this speaker, this song's coming from this speaker, this song's coming from this speaker, and hope that they get it. Okay, and then the active phase is she has to perch here to elicit the playback of that song. She has to perch here to elicit the playback of that song, and over this testing period, her preference is observed in the difference between perch hops on A versus perch hops on B. It's pretty easy. We're trying to get touch screens going, kind of like my neighbor. So we're trying to get touch screens going so that we can do audio-visual, mismatching and see which one wins or, if they can detect the difference. But that's ongoing. That's one of my undergrad's projects. Okay, the brain. So There's a pretty good swath of tissue devoted to auditory processing in the cortex. The brain, the hindbrain, brainstem nuclei can be easily mapped on to mammalian nuclei. They don't, there are not as many, but their homologies are clear and their functions are very similar. Cochlear nuclei, the auditory midbrain, the bird's eye see is this nexus for converging inputs. Then information is sent to the thalamus, and I spent many years here in order to just figure out the very easiest part. So lower in the sensory system, you expect things to be more linear. You can calculate receptive fields using linear, nonlinear models, etc., and that turns out to be true. And when you get up here, it gets tougher and tougher and tougher to figure out what's going on, but of course that's what we're interested in. Okay. So in order to keep this sort of simplified, what we've done is a lot of work to map these regions onto mammalian cortical layers, just see if that works, and it does work. You guys probably, some of you know Harvey Karton. Harvey Karton first proposed that the avian forebrain was homologous, the projections and the functional systems were homologous in the forebrain between mammals and birds back when this entire area was called the basal ganglia of birds. It was just completely wrong. And once we were able to, you know, label for cell types and dopamine, and it was very clear that there is a basal ganglia and this ain't it, okay? And so, so genetically identified cell types, that, you know, just data coming in, showing some pretty nice parallels between the mammalian layers and these regions that are in no way the cortical phyllodo-laminated structure that you see. They're more like regions. I'll show you some pictures. So we published a paper in 2015 that was the functional work. So we recorded from neurons in each of these areas, and I think I'm going to show you a little summary of this, and found that the neurons here are much like layer 4 neurons. They also receive, they're the thalamorecipient region, so we call those input or intermediate, okay? So they'd be like layer 4. They're small, they fire a lot, they're linear. And then projections go up to the superficial regions, down to the deep output regions, and then into the secondary region, which is very interesting, and we do not know how to map that onto mammalian auditory cortex yet, because frankly we don't know much about belt and parabelt, and so it's difficult for us to we have a lot of data about here about this these cells, but we don't know how to map that onto the mammal so far, and we're just trying to figure out how this system works. Okay. So this is the sort of circuit diagram. This is what it looks like in, okay, this is a sagittal section. So the auditory cortex is back here. Sagittal section through. This is just white light. And you see the thalamic fibers coming into this field L2, which is very confusing because it's the equivalent of layer 4. Okay. And then these other areas are defined by laminae, or if you look closely at Nissl stain or you look at particular gene expression patterns, you can delineate these other regions, but it is in no way similar to the lamination that we see in the mammalian cortex, which is, of course, quite different across mammals as well. But functionally speaking, the connectivity, the response properties, and I'll show you a bunch of evidence for that, are quite well mapped.
What is the horizontal mapping that you have here? This is the vertical mapping.
Yeah, this is sagittal. Yeah. What does horizontal look like?
In the human case, you have layer 4, layer 2 and 1 upstairs.
Right.
And 5 and 6. And the upper layers are sort of the integrate other input from outside.
Right.
And the 5 and 6 sort of go to the inner system.
They go to the what?
to relate to the inner system.
Yeah, so we have the same situation here. These regions receive input from other regions. They're connected to the secondary region here. And these regions, this region and this region, and we now understand everything gets more and more, everything is rather simple and linear here, and it reminds me a lot of the midbrain in this input region. It gets a little more complicated here in terms of estimating receptive fields, reliability of neurons, song coding, etc. And then it really gets interesting here and here. And I'm going to show you a little.
So can I ask you, like, for this number
feature, L1, L2, L3,
like, who named
those? Okay. Rose named the bird auditory forebrain Field L in 1949. Mm-hmm. And he had no idea that he would later be confusing us to no end.
Oh,
okay. Because layers, you know, and if there are layers here, you know. So he called this whole thing Field L, okay, and then name this L2, L1. This is caudal mesopallium. This is L3, and this is an area called NC.
But the whole thing together is called Field L.
Not this. So he left this out, and no one knew that that had anything to do with auditory processing. Okay.
So you have an amplifier layer and two layers like the ones that you need for implementing the XOR on below as well.
Which is the amplifying layer?
Layer 4.
Yes. So layer 4 kind of gives you what you give it. I'll show you some examples. Okay. So it's, you know, what do you give me? A chorus and a target song? Well, I'm going to give you the chorus and the target song back. Okay, they give you back the acoustic scene within their tuning parameters. Okay, and later on, that is not the case.
What's that little guy at the end of L2? This little circle. Right?
This?
Yeah.
That's L2B. of course, my dear. That's L2B. And they do, you know, L2B does have phylemic projections, but the major recipient is L2. Like, when you're driving your electrode through L2, you forget it trying to isolate a single neuron. It's very difficult because they're high-firing, small cells, densely packed. And then later on, the scene changes. And we've been working very hard to figure out, to describe that so that we could understand how the system is being used for perception.
L2A is everything else,
it does not be used. L2A is right here.
That's A.
Yeah. Okay. That's B. And where you see these that dark, those are fibers coming in from the thalamus.
Is there an alternative to cause this for the different bird species?
For the ones we work on, it's virtually the same. We use the same stereotaxic coordinates. We don't even note the difference. They are very similar size, but we just put one species in, and you know it's a fit. Then we find our regions. That's not to say that on Friday I'll show you there's some important differences. Okay, so the general stream. Now this is never a correct statement, right? There are always feedback loops, but the general flow, to make it simple for ourselves, is the input to the superficial, to the deep output, to the secondary. Okay, and I'll show you a little evidence for that now. Will I? Yes. Okay. So we now the modern era, we use 32-channel silicon probes that have 32 electrically conducting contacts on them, okay? We used to just one pipette, one cell at a time. We don't do that anymore. And so we drive these shanks through the auditory cortex and record a bird's neural responses to songs, tones, and lots of other sounds, okay? And we do it day after day so that we can map certain tuning features in 3D space tissue-wise. Okay. This is a kind of more true to life circuit diagram than this. And when we do this with either tones or noise, something very simple. Song is too complex to measure for spike latencies, really, because it has, the tuning of the neuron is going to mess with you there. So if we use noise or tones, we see the shortest latencies here in the intermediate region, followed by the superficial and deep regions, and then last, the longest latencies are in the secondary region. And that's using both noise and a neuron's best frequency.
The thing you're driving through is 32 individual needles, each capable of making a loop?
32, okay, there are four needles.
Four total, yes.
Yeah, and they each have all along the far tips of the shank electrically conducting contacts.
And the four are a 2x2 array, or are they
linear? There, you can order any configuration you want. We use four going in. And depending upon our experiments, we do this or we do this. And the birds are awake. We do the surgery beforehand. Is this going to go on the web? We do the surgery. Beep this, will you? The surgery, of course, is done under, anesthesia, and then there's a little craniotomy covered in the silicone. There's a little pin that holds the head fixed, and then every day we put Birdie in the stereotacs and in the walk-in booth, and for about 4 or 5 hours, Bird will accommodate you. And then you take Birdie out, put Birdie back in the home cage, and we do this for about a week, depending upon the value of the animal, whether we've cross-tutored it or something.
And this bird is vocalizing as well as it's listening?
No. Just listening. They don't vocalize when they're in the booth. Although I have a friend who has trained them to sing when head fixed, because he studies the motor patterns. So it's doable, but for us, that's just a confound. We want that bird quiet. Okay, so the way we reconstruct where every single one of our neurons was is we paint the shanks of the silicon probes with dye eye. Okay, and then we'd later do histology to reconstruct. You can see this pitchfork. We later do histology to reconstruct where we were. And we have other fluorescent dyes if we make another set of penetrations, and eventually you can reconstruct where you were in these regions, because that's one of the things we study of, like, what's the transformation and the representation of a song or tuning properties, etc., as you move through the cortical circuit. Okay, so here we always play tones. I used to think I hated the auditory system, and I told Ed Rubel, my mentor, that on a daily basis, because it was foolish of me, but it was all about sound localization in the brainstem nuclei, and then it was all tones and noise bursts, and for me, I'm one of those people who thinks you're never going to figure out how the brain works until you get to the real stimuli, you get to the natural stimuli. And so I used to be, oh, Ed, come on, until we can calculate a receptive field from the responses to song, I don't care, and then someone figured out how to do that. We always record this whole region is tonotopically mapped, like the midbrain and like ovoidalis, which is the thalamus. I'll show you. I have some maps to show you. It's continuous, so we don't see this reversal that the low frequency and then out to high and out to high that we see in the mammalian across surface tissue that is seen in the mammalian cortex. So we calculate FRAs, which are frequency response area plots, where the color here indicates firing rate, and so you vary the tone frequency, and you vary the intensity of your tones randomly, of course, and you reconstruct what are the frequencies and at what intensities is my neuron driven, okay? And so this is the very most basic form of receptive field you can come up with.
And
Sorry, this, you're just measuring the sort of actual value of the firing rate. You don't care if it's phase long or.
In this analysis, no, we don't.
I guess we couldn't phase long to kill it. Okay.
Exactly. So they do phase. They do have very nice temporal responses, but in this type of analysis, we do actually we do four. We do the average during the stim. We do after the stim. We do the FRA after the stim. So the offset FRA. We do the onset FRA. So some neurons have only onset responses. Some neurons have a big onset response and then plateau. Said primary-like, you know, and some just so it is important to capture that when you're trying to use responses to tones to see what you can predict about responses to something like song. So we do four generally. I'm just showing you the excitatory, the on stimulus FRA now, and so we see these nice tuning curves. This is the input region, one neuron example, and you would see. This looks very much like the midbrain. Not all of them, as we all, those of us who are physiologists know, every auditory neuron has its own personality. They're never identical.
But why haven't you, I mean, I think I agree with you that it's sometimes not too informative to always use tones only to characterize the system. So have you tried with complex tones or with certain dynamic?
Absolutely.
Tones.
Yes.
If you tried that, or what would you expect? Then, let's say you said yourself that you find this limited. This analysis.
Right.
So where would you go?
So it's just your basic who are you question.
Yes.
But one of the things that we showed in the midbrain, I don't know what, 5 years ago or something, even in the midbrain, okay. You have two-tone facilitation, where you have, this is just your visible, you know, you're above the, what are the iceberg, you know. This is just what you can see of the excitatory receptive field. But there are non-classical excitatory receptive fields and or inhibitory sidebands lurking, okay. So if you play two tones, you can evoke a response. Yeah, so we did a whole study in the midbrain on that.
So you have to.
Yeah. Yes, and we play ripples. We play. I mean, you name it. I've played it. The most telling, most useful for us so far has been the ripples of various spectral temporal modulations, okay. Just like Shihab would predict. And we find this. If we measure best frequency, or characteristic frequency, or bandwidths, they do not tell us. What types of songs the neuron will fire most. Okay. So this is a superficial neuron, this is a deep output neuron, and this is a secondary neuron. In general, the FRAs get more complex. The responses become less reliable. The STRFs, the spectrotemporal receptive fields that we calculate, become, you know, more difficult, poorer models of predicting the responses to novel stimuli. As you move from here to here. Here's the map of tonotopia. I don't know how fascinating, none of us can ever figure out why these things are mapped, you know? But as Josh was saying the other day, it's very handy experimentally, because it helps you know where you are, you know? So this is a caudal rostral, okay, sagittal section. Depth is going down, and we are just off the midline, less than a millimeter off the midline. And what you can see is that the neurons are organized from low frequency, best frequency, to high. And this is going through the regions. And we see the same thing. We move out, a millimeter out. We see it also a little past a millimeter, and then the organization goes away. So the neurons are perfectly responsive, but the organization of tonotopy goes away. And if you go further out over here, the neurons are not auditory, and they're in fact visual. And there's a guy named Andreas Snyder who studies this area, calls it the end brain. I don't know why, but I believe it. and it's lateral NC, and it's visual, but the visual responses are modulated by auditory input. And so that he studies that area, but he cannot find just an auditory response, and that concurs with what we also have.
So does the tonotopy sort of gradually fade, or I missed this, or is there a layer where it just disappears?
No, it gradually fades as far as we know. Yeah, I mean we really need to. Well, we do have thousands of neurons now. So I'm gonna propose gradual, because it's true in every animal we've seen, and we put the group data together. It just becomes disorganized gradually. And then you just don't get any responses. Yeah?
I just have a question on the experiments itself. So do you have any damage, and would that have any effect on the animals?
Damage to the brain. There's no doubt we do. Because these are not, giant tree trunk ABR-like electrodes. But they are, we drive them down in, then down in, then down in, then the next day, down and down. But then if you look at the Nissl, you sometimes can't even see a track. It's not like the pipette days or the big tungsten electrode days. But invariably, there's damage. And if you record out to 10 days, you're trying to get data out of this special animal, your yield goes down. So you've caused some damage. But we do also calculate our tuning properties the first 3 days, and then the next 3 days, and then try to estimate if we're actually observing any observable differences in the cells we get over time.
The same for the different levels in the processing pipeline?
The what?
So if you have damage, so does it show similarly for all the levels?
Good question. It's confounded by definitely the surface. You have some damage, but that's the hippocampus, so who cares? Right. No, I'm kidding. You have some damage after a week, and you just see it. But and as you go deeper, the cells are more spread out in NC and in the deep output region, and so it's as if the perception is that you are doing less damage, but we haven't quantified it. Okay. So, in general, I'm going to show you more examples of this, but okay, so we play this sound called modulation limited noise. And many of us know that white noise shuts down a cortical neuron. Not every one of them, but you get an onset response, boom, nothing. So we made this stimulus back when I was a postdoc with Frederick Tunison. We were already into modulation spectra, and we made this stimulus where we said, okay, we're going to make a decorrelated stimulus, but it's going to have the boundary, it's going to be limited by the maximum spectral modulation frequencies in zebrafinch song in this case, because we were studying the zebrafinch, and the maximum temporal modulation frequencies. And everything in there, in between, all the upsweeps and downsweeps that can be included in that matrix, okay, were put together to generate this stimulus. So it's like you took white noise and stretched it in spectrum and in time, okay? Slowed it down a little. Let's see if I can imitate it for you. It's not natural, let me tell you. It sounds like, and it does not shut down our neurons. So that little trick seemed to work to make a decorrelated stimulus that was a fair test in comparing to something like a response to song. So that's what this thing is called. And so what we see here is these are dot raster plots. And all they are is, this is 10 trials of playing this song, and the very top row is just one time we played the song, and there's a little tick every time the neuron fired. Everything I'm going to show you, unless I specify, is single neurons. Okay. So there's a little tick every time the neuron fires, okay? Then you play another stimulus, and you come back around to this particular white noise, and then you line up your second row of ticks indicating when in the stimulus the neuron fired. And if you have a highly reliable neuron, meaning I respond the same way every time you play that particular noise sample to me, and if you have good temporal precision, stimulus locking onto some feature in that stimulus, you end up with a barcode pattern that shows you the response of that neuron to that stimulus.
What would, if you had a noise with a similar bandwidth, but only temporal, as a fluctuation, and temporal envelope modulations of random character, but you would not look at particularly at the frequency modulations.
Yeah.
What would happen then? Would they then also, would they also respond?
It would depend upon how sensitive they are to amplitude, but very likely they would respond to it, because they need a cessation of a high amplitude sound in order to reset and fire again. And the input, these input neurons love noise compared to the later, more finicky neurons.
But also,
so if you if you decrease it, if you make the depth low enough, you'll reset your neuron and you'll get a nice response. And the midbrain loves, the midbrain loves white noise.
But you need also the spectral modulations, yeah? So these wobbles or whatever.
Right, so we just wanted to make a decorrelated stimulus that had some rule by which we made it. And so we set the boundary, the max spectral modulation frequencies and the max temporal modulation frequencies, made a matrix of all those and all those single ripples and put them together. So this is a nice neuron that stimulus locks. You can see it fires quite a lot when there's no sound on, so we also have suppression. And as we move into the deep regions, on average, and I'll explain why, on average, the neurons become much more sparse in their firing. And in fact, they break out into two types of cells very clearly. Okay, and those two types of cells are the same major types of cells that we see in mammalian cortex, the putative excitatory neuron called a regular spiker or broad spiker. Now, this is identified by the shape of the action potential. Okay, and your narrow spikers or fast spikers, they fire more. And those two cell types differentiate very clearly as you progress. And I have some pie charts to show you the relative proportions of those two types of cells. Okay, so these are spectrotemporal receptive fields showing that you have, you know, early on in this intermediate region, a STIRF, a linear nonlinear model, will do a decent job of predicting the responses to a novel stimulus. Okay, later on, forget it. You do see more complex receptive fields, and then eventually you're just playing with noise. Okay, and so that's these are measures of changes in response to this stimulus that occur through the cortical circuit. Okay. And so the sparseness is how many neurons are active at any given epoch of sound, okay? And it's the lowest in the input region, as we would expect, and progresses to that secondary region. The selectivity is a similar question. How many of my stimuli do you respond to, neuron? And this is the inverse of it because it's selectivity. So an input neuron, an intermediate region neuron, will give you a response to the vast majority of the stimuli, okay, like the midbrain will. And then the neurons become pickier and pickier and pickier as you move through the circuit. These are measures taken from the STIRF's receptive field separability. How separable is, meaning how sort of simply modeled by an SVD, is the pattern of excitation and inhibition we see in the STIRF. And then linearity is a measure of how well that receptive field model does in predicting the response to a novel stimulus. And it tanks, okay, as you move from the input region to the secondary region. What's this? Oh, yeah. And this is just firing rates. Okay, so This area here, I mean, it's very hard to isolate single neurons using these neuron axis probes with a lot of densely packed high firing redundant coding neurons here, and it gets much easier as firing rates increase. So these are the two cell types I was telling you about, and they map onto those that are in the, we didn't even know that the bird had these two cell types before like 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago. And so we record and analyze the action potentials, that's how we sort spikes into single neurons, of every cell, and they fall into two categories. And nobody believed these bimodal distributions when we first submitted this, because it's so good. No, nothing in biology is that clear, a bimodal distribution. So we had to do it with chronic recordings in a baby. We had to do it in long-term acute recordings in anesthesia, and this sort of in-between awake adult animal, and every time they fall out based on the width of the action potential. You can do Gaussian mixture modeling, blah, 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 and you're like four cells different in where you draw this line. Okay, so if you just measure the width of the action potential, you assign it a regular spiker or a fast spiker, okay? Putative excitatory neuron, putative inhibitory neuron. And this is showing that there is the greater the width of the action potential, the lower the firing rate of the neuron, okay? Which also matches onto mammalian, these two major cell types in mammals. Okay, so here I'm just demonstrating this for you, okay? This is a regular spiker, fat action potential, putative excitatory neuron, okay, in the intermediate region. Here's a fast spiker, okay, two different cells responding to noise, the modulation limited noise, okay. And you say, so maybe the firing rate's a little higher here, maybe. So as you progress through the processing regions, you see that the fast spiking neurons, those narrow spiking putative inhibitory neurons, maintain a pretty decent firing rate. They go down a little, but the regular spikers become sparse, and uber sparse. Can you see that here? Okay. And I made my poor students do this. They're like, oh, Sarah, a pie chart? What is this, USA Today? You know? But it is, you know, easy and clear. So the relative proportions of fast spiker to regular spiker change from largely in the input region, these fast spikers, gradually to a vast majority of regular spikers in those secondary and deep output regions.
Did you say gradually?
Gradually, okay, so mostly black jump. Is that what you're saying? Okay, yeah, I'm with you, yeah, you're right, there's a jump. Because it's like granule cells. These neurons are, it's very difficult. I mean, do I believe that 73% of the input region neurons are inhibitory? I have a hard time believing that, so I don't know. But they are fast spikers. Yeah, you're right, jump, better put.
Easy to tell.
And then it just gets a little stronger later.
Is this related to parvalbumin expression, or?
We do not know in the birds. We haven't tested that yet. Likely, but there are a lot of different types of inhibitory neurons.
Maybe I missed it, but is this stimulus in some way interesting to the bird?
No.
Maybe
that's why you do all this basic stuff, right? You do all this basic stuff with the boring stimuli.
So I say, well, I'm just forgetting something, I'm not interested.
Right, yes, I'm with you, although it does help you, because with song, you can't estimate first spike latency.
No, I apologize.
Oh, okay. All right.
I mean, there are lots of things we hear that, you know,
we don't have to. Sure. I mean, after all, perception is just for living things out which we don't want, right?
That's a big part of it. Okay, on to, you asked, and I made it happen. On to a more interesting stimulus, which is a song. So these are the trial by trial over multiple trials responses of a single neuron to this song, the same neuron responding to this long-tailed finch song, okay? And what you can see is that they're reliable, and this is how we measure reliability. We measure whether the spike train in response to one song can be distinguished from the spike train in response to another song using k-means and Euclidean distance measures of spike train patterns. Okay. And more importantly for us, when we see a response like this or like this, we see something interesting here. It's not, the neuron is not sputtering. It's not just willy-nilly excited by the song, okay? It's not egalitarian with regard to the syllable that is being presented. The neuron is more stimulated by these syllables and by this portion of this syllable than by these, even though you have some nice lined up responses here.
Are these responses, these are not responses to single trials, these are also averaged, huh?
This is one single trial.
Yes, but the response as the neural pattern, is this a response to one single trial?
Yeah, okay. Well, this row is one response to that.
Yeah,
now, it comes back around in the random rotation.
Yes.
Same song, yeah.
Yes, okay, I see. Sorry.
And then,
yeah.
If we average it, we get the PSTH.
Yes.
The peristimulus time histogram, and we could say, okay, what's the average?
It looks like this response could be explained by like a low frequency response, because those syllables that you pointed out that spiking less also have a higher frequency from somewhere.
Exactly. That would also be my guess. And this, you know, these have a low component, and this sweeps down into low and evokes a response, right? So that's how you start, right? That, and then 10 years later, you're still trying to figure it out. What's this? Oh, one of the things that emerges, so that noise stimulus we played, now if you play the noise stimulus, say five different epochs of the noise, and then five different zebrafinch songs, the neurons in the intermediate region, the input region, will fire with equal firing rate to both categories of sounds. Okay, so there's no selectivity for song over this noise, this weird, boring noise, as you pointed out, boring noise stimulus, okay? But the selectivity emerges. The selectivity for song over noise emerges as we progress through the circuit. And we have a lot more understanding of that now, and that will be what I talk about, one of the things I talk about Friday. Okay, so I just want to show you, okay, if we play the same song, okay, to how many? 16 midbrain neurons, okay, we see that each neuron has its own personality. It responds reliably and to specific things in that song, okay? And we will get a nice STRF or STRF from that neuron often. When we move into these data are from before we separated it out in all the different regions, okay? We move into the primary forebrain, the field L area, okay, primary AC. The firing rates go down, but you still see very nice stimulus locking and reliability in general, okay? And here is where we discovered, this is the secondary region that I have beige colored, okay. Nobody ever found these neurons because think about how we search for neurons. We got an electrode in there, we're driving, we've got a little sound stimulus, we wait, we listen to spot. Whoever fires the most, we find. Okay? So no one had ever found these neurons because you've got to listen very carefully. You've got to listen for spot. You've got to not go with the bias of the higher firing rate neurons. And it turns out that these are the regular spiking neurons, and they, like I just told you, they're also in the deep output, right? They're also in the superficial, but we didn't see them. We found them here because they were in decent quantity for us to run across them despite the biases that are inherent to electrophysiological recording. And this is just to demonstrate that when you have a lot of spikes, you have nice stimulus locking, you have reliability, you can usually get a STRF, or spectrotemporal receptive field, that does some decent job at explaining the variance of the response. These cells, we absolutely failed. Okay. And this is the little plot here. So the cross correlations between the predictions and the actual responses to novel stimuli are very low in these neurons, and they're medium in other neurons. We can get on to something more fun. Okay. So another thing that's become a key analysis technique for us. Remember, I was saying that if you take the responses of this one neuron, okay, to this song, 10 responses, okay, and you average those, you get a peristimulus time histogram. What's the average response across, time-varying response across? Now, you can also do that for your 300 neurons in a single region. And you'd almost be an idiot to do that because every neuron likes a different thing. But what turns out to be true is that isn't correct. So within a region, the neurons average 300, 400, 56, whatever. You know, we take what we can get. If we average the responses of, let's take 150 mid-range neurons in this deep output region indicated by the blue here, and we make a population PSDH. If every neuron were interested in something different, you'd get a flat line here, okay? But you don't. You get very specific peaks. And that suggested then to us that within a region, the neurons share a tuning property that emerges when you average all of their responses, and you could probably observe at the multi-unit level, but we like to start with single unit and then put them back together. And this is showing for all the deep region zebrafinch neurons we recorded from in response to this song, that's the orange trace. The gray trace is the same brain region, but all the long-tail finch neurons we recorded in response to this zebrafinch song. And what you see is that they're different. Okay, so if the neurons...
Yeah, no.
You with me? Okay. So if the neurons in two different species, deep output neurons in two different closely related distributed species are interested in the same sounds, have the same tuning properties, the gray and the orange would overlap each other. Together, and they don't. So that, we got very excited because then it means there's a species difference. Yeah?
How close are they between different individuals of the same species, those curves? Or is this average over many individuals?
Oh, it's average across all the cells we recorded from in many individuals.
And how similar are they when you look at different individuals of the same species?
Right. Okay. That is a very good question, and we have done that. They're similar, but I can't quantify it for you. But they're similar enough to create these very precise across individuals and across hundreds of neurons. Create these very precise peaks in the responses.
So could you recognize the species from looking at this pattern?
Yeah, because look over here at the long-tail finch song. These are the long-tail finch neurons. These are the zebrafinch neurons, okay? And so we've done the average, like what's your average firing rate to the five zebrafinch songs versus the five long-tail finch songs? And I have that Friday, and it's an interesting story. The crux of the matter is there's no selectivity for conspecific song in the input region, and it emerges through the circuit.
But what is it then that characterizes these patterns? So is it then certain sensitivity or selectivity to some features?
Yes. Yes, it is. But that's the hard job, right? Is you have to figure out. You could get a clue, right? But you have to quantify it. You have to come up with a stimulus that's a synthetic stimulus that can be parameterized in the parameters that you think might be interesting, and see if you can predict that from another. And we have been able to do that.
You have been already. You have been here.
El Shihab.
Yeah. Always.
So I'll just tell you that we analyzed the best frequency of every neuron from the tone responses, the bandwidths, the temporal response functions. Now, certainly, you know, the frequency range to which a neuron is sensitive does play a role in what it responds to. But the best frequencies, the bandwidths of a neuron did not co-vary with their selectivity for song, for one species song versus another. Did not explain it. And they differed in between a species that sings this and this, the bandwidths did not differ. So we knew, and I've kind of known this, some of us, even being one of them as well, Josh as well, we knew, you know, that natural sounds aren't tones. A whistle is as close as you're going to, white crowned sparrows, introductory whistles, as close as you're going to get to a tone. And in fact, what better characterizes a vocalization are the spectral and temporal modulation frequencies, or the statistical structure of those vocalizations. So what we do now is we take a song and we decompose a syllable into its ripple or Fourier components, or we just do it the dumb way, which is my favorite way, which is the labor-intensive way. But you take a note, you take a syllable or a note, and you quantitatively map the match between that note and all of the ripples that you that include power in your whole species song. Okay? And then you say, okay, what ripple best represents this note? Okay, and you create ripple syllables, ripple songs, etc. Okay, and in that way you say, okay, what are the modulation frequencies, meaning spectral modulation frequencies, okay, and temporal modulation frequencies, fast, slow, nothing, okay, and a combination of a spectral modulation frequency and a temporal modulation frequency gives you upsweeps and downsweeps.
Well, yeah, that's one way to characterize the stimulus, the input dimensions. I mean, that's clear. That must be each dynamic or complex stimulus must be represented or can be represented by this type,
yes,
of representation.
That's right. So
the question is what the system does. So what
I
is,
know.
What
I, I'm,
is,
t- I'm, totally with
I'm
totally
the
with you.
Selectivity and so what is really doing,
okay,
going on in the
right.
Book
so
that you have.
So I do. Yes. I do. But I don't. We're going to get to that Friday. Will you still be here?
Yeah. Yes.
All right. So the fun thing about this is that you could take your complex stimulus that I've been dying to try to understand for a million years, but it's so complex. You can turn it into a picture like this. With these, what are the ripple components that create my syllable? Okay. And you can also take these and make sounds of them. They're the
Your frequency scales are linear.
Yeah, spectrograms, and they're linear.
In mammalian, things would be logarithmic.
That's right. That's right. So the bird
could. Berkeley style.
What's that?
This is a Berkeley style.
A Berkeley style because Berkeley works on birds.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So we have good reason for that. We have good reason for that.
I mean, I'm disappointed in linear scale, but I'm not a gardener.
Well, the bird cochlea is not log, first of all.
Is it so linear?
Yeah. And we can't find any evidence.
I apologize for this first comment on spectrogram. Obviously, for birds, it's wonderful. Spectrogram is very
rare
for birds. Yeah.
But you're also right that for speech recognition, so that doesn't, it wasn't particularly informative, right, to read the spectrogram and then tell
in
them.
In a linear.
But here, I think it's linear. Different.
Right, because the proper transform.
It didn't stop.
Like you need a cochleogram.
It didn't stop people using it.
So the selectivity of different frequency channels is constant, the bandwidth is constant.
In what?
So it's not constantly breaking.
It's interesting.
The selectivity of the frequency channels, where? In the ear or in the...
In the... To fit the approximation, the Lamaillian cochlear is constant.
Oh, you mean, is it truly linear? The answer is no.
Yeah, so it's not just the scale, but it's the
bandwidth.
So the filters are fixed bandwidth on a linear scale, meaning, for example, 100 hertz.
It's not purely linear either. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm talking about four papers here, right? Mm-hmm. With auditory nerve recordings and, you know, and in the starling is where this work was done. Also, we can't find any octave generalization in perception of, in bird. There's a paper Ani Patel and Tim Gentner published this year, showing that they can't get birds to do octave generalization. But you know, I leave it open, right? I just try, see what works, right? But there is a very clear, we're not just dumb when we use a linear spectrum. There's a reason for it. Okay, so are you comfortable with these things? This is white noise. Okay, and this is the dimension of spectral modulation frequency. The more densely packed are your spectral modulations, the lower is the pitch of your harmonic stack, okay? And that's measured in cycles per kilohertz. Come on, give me back cycles back per octave. Come on. No, okay. Yeah?
We have just a few minutes.
Okay. I don't have any particular agenda. Okay, so so the way I used to do this was do a 2D Fourier decomposition of song, of a whole bunch of songs. And it's called a modulation power spectrum. And there's a problem with that technique, and that is everything that can't be fit to a sine wave in your complex sound just gets put at zero. And it's like every analysis technique has biases, okay? And so I was so sick of that I said, we're just gonna go through and match, okay, these auditory gratings or ripples to the best ripple to each of our notes as we go through all of our songs, okay? And then we're gonna say how much of the song is represented by this ripple, what proportion of the song is best mapped onto by this ripple, by this ripple, by this ripple, okay? And when we do that for zebrafinch song, we see something that actually makes sense. Okay, we see that there's a range of harmonic stacks with different densities, as shown here, and that there's energy in the slow but packed spectral modulations, slow down sweeps. Okay, and so this is how we are at the moment, certainly not ideal perfected, at the moment, characterizing the modulation frequencies that represent songs of different species, and then going in and playing all those ripples and recording the responses of auditory neurons and saying, do the ripples that drive you neurons map on to the modulation frequencies in your song?
So does it say that the upper sweeps are not so important?
They're not well represented in zebrafinch song. This looks very different. This is all right here, and I will get to that on Friday, and I'm gonna finish.
Can we just so how critical your analysis was with these joint modulations? So you said you have the purely spectral, purely temporal, and then the joint spectrotemporal ripples.
Right.
Are they, because they
are very important in distinguishing the songs.
Yeah, it's a lot going in the stimulus space, but often in the modeling, so I'm not sure how...
I have all the tuning to show you on Friday. Or later on, if you prefer. And I didn't get to my cocktail party, thing, but another day. Thank you.
Good.